Police have also conducted an internal investigation into the email. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A large voter registration effort for tribal communities is taking place in Oklahoma today on National Voter Registration Day. Lawyers, law students, and volunteers are staffing locations throughout the state to register voters at tribal headquarters, including the Kiowa and Comanche Nations. They're also covering two urban locations, the Oklahoma City Indian Health Clinic and Norman's University of Oklahoma College of Law. The Oklahoma Indian Bar Association is leading the effort and is also participating in the nationwide Native Vote effort. According to the Bar Association, historically, for a variety of reasons, the registration levels and voting turnout of Native Americans has been among the lowest of any group in the U.S. The organization is hoping to help change that by making it easy for tribal communities to register and exercise their right to vote. The organization is also informing people about Oklahoma's new voter ID laws. Voters will have to have a photo ID with an expiration date or a voter registration card in order to vote this year. A majority of tribal ID cards likely will not qualify for voting purposes. So they're urging people to remember to bring an unexpired state or federal issued photo ID to the polls. Additional tribal communities in Oklahoma are also hosting registration events this week. Sea Alaska Heritage Institute has produced a 3-volume set of teaching materials on Alaska Native history. It was developed for grades 6 through 8 and examines Alaska Native history from the Native view. It includes the landmark Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, or ANCSA. The Alaska Heritage Institute President Rosita Worrell says it's important for students and others to understand ANCSA, which was passed by Congress in 1971.
During the last 40 years, it's had profound effect on Alaska and Alaska Natives, both politically, economically, and even socially.
Other topics include human migration, clans, traditional beliefs, ceremonies, and traditional shelters. The materials are also designed to teach vocabulary words. The teaching tool is based on Alaska performance standards and funded by a federal grant. Materials will be sent to schools in Southeast Alaska and accessible online at SeaAlaskaHeritage.org. Units on math, science, and native languages will be made available later this year. During this month in 2011, public meetings to discuss missing and murdered Aboriginal women were held in several communities in northern British Columbia, Canada. The Missing Women Commission held the forums, which included addressing cases on a stretch of road between Prince Rupert and Prince George, known as the Highway of Tears. People called for a special Amber Alert and a public shuttle. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're back with us. We're in the middle of Juneau afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today. It's about 6 minutes after 3 o'clock. And this weekend, there's going to be a special concert at JDHS. It's on Sunday at 2 p.m. The artist is Jim Cosgrove, and he's known as Mr. Stinky Feet. Let's hear a sample of his music.
Stinky feet. Stinky feet. My brother's got stinky feet. Stinky feet. Stinky feet. My brother's got stinky feet. He takes his shoes off at the door. He throws his socks right on the floor. He rubs his toes and says they're sore. I don't think I can take it anymore. Stinky feet. Stinky feet. My brother's got stinky feet. Stinky feet. Stinky feet. My sister's got stinky feet. She wears the same shoes every day. She tells my mom she likes it that way. I think she's scaring her friends away. I just don't know how to say. You've got stinky feet. Stinky feet. My sister's got stinky feet. Stinky feet. Stinky feet. My sister's got stinky feet. And man, her feet
smells so bad, I can't stay in the same room with her. And when she and my brother get together, whew, I've got to leave the house. Now could someone please explain to me why dogs and cats don't get stinky feet? And has anyone ever seen a parakeet walking around with stinky feet? You know, I think just you and me are the only ones that ever get stinky feet. Stinky feet. Everybody gets stinky feet. Stinky feet. Stinky feet. Everybody gets stinky feet. Clap your feet and wiggle your toes. Spray them down with a rubber hose. Dress them up in some fancy clothes. Just keep them away from my sensitive nose. Stinky feet. Stinky feet. Stinky feet. Be-you!
Well, you can hear more of that sterling music this weekend when Mr. Cosgrove, Jim Cosgrove, is here in town. He's here Sunday playing at JDHS Auditorium. The concert is at 2 p.m. And this is a concert to benefit our Montessori schools here in Juneau. So his other numbers include things like Rachel's Garden, Frog in a Bog, the Diaper Bag Boogie. I'm not sure where we're going here, but anyway, you may want to take that concert in. It's at JDHS Auditorium. It's at 2 p.m. on Sunday. There's another event coming up which you may want to take some action on and get yourself together. I'm not sure if by this weekend you have time to grow a pumpkin, but this is the weekend of the second annual Great Pumpkin Festival in Juneau. And basically, coming up Thursday of this week, there will be a set of entries for the kerchunking contest. That'll take place at Sandy Beach. People have been building catapults, I understand, to launch pumpkins. So we have quite an event coming on there. That'll be Thursday, and from 8:30 to 9:30 in the morning, you're to bring your catapult to Juneau Arts and Culture Center, and then they get transported down to Sandy Beach so that between 5:30 and 7:30, we can chunk pumpkins. Friday, September 28th, entries are all open. There will be some fair festivities from 5 to 9 p.m. again at the Jack. And Saturday, September 29th, culinary entries only, and the fair is open from 10 until 5. So the fair takes place in the Jack. Some of the events that are going to happen, the Percussions of Doom will be doing live music at 11 o'clock in the morning on Friday. The fair organizers will open the fair officially at noon. The crop entrance will provide photo opportunities with the entrance, including large cabbages and pumpkins. So if you've always wanted to be part of a photograph with a large cabbage or a pumpkin, this is your opportunity. All of the entrants will be judged. Divisions champion, champion, reserve, and first places are to be awarded by 2:45. There'll be a pie-eating contest, three heats of that with 18 contestants total. Gardening tips for Southeast Alaska will be a presentation at 3:45 in the afternoon. There will be a silent auction going out and throughout the day. That will finish up at about 4 o'clock, and it will close with words and a song. The event is closing to the public at 5 o'clock. This is a volunteer-supported official fair, and if you would like to help clean up after all of this happens in the Jack, you are more than welcome to call 907-586-1616 or go on their Facebook page. Just get yourself on Facebook and then take yourself to the Pumpkin Festival page, or you can email at janupumpkinfestival@gmail.com and volunteer to help out with any and all of these activities. So that is the event that's coming up. In a couple of minutes here, we've got Ken Fix lined up to come into the studio and tell us about the Mars rovers. First, this.
Spirit of Youth celebrates teenage Alaskans who are making our communities better places to live. They give their time, their hearts and minds, their passion, their creativity. Now, hear their stories.
The Anchorage School District is the state's largest, so its single student school board representative has a pretty big responsibility. Until he graduated this year, 18-year-old Ivan Echeverry held that position. He says it's like being the voice for all 50,000 kids who go to school in the area.
I go to the board meetings, which usually last 5 to 6 hours. I have to read big packets full of memorandums. On top of that, I also founded an event on the west side of Anchorage called Westfest, and it was games. It was a carnival. It had games, free food, just everything basically for free for lower-income families in the west side of Anchorage so they could have fun and not feel the pressure of having to let go of their money.
Ivan says with his school board and West Fest activities, plus other ways he volunteers, he puts in about 70 hours of community service each month. But even with all that engagement, Ivan says being a volunteer isn't his first calling. His real passion is for the arts.
I decided I wanted to be an actor when I was 6. Then I went to West and I did a lot of acting. I became a member of Thespian Society among a bunch of other clubs there. And you know, acting has just always been my main goal.
Ivan was offered a large scholarship to attend the New York Conservatory for Dramatic Arts in New York City.
They really like me a lot because of what I do for the community. So it's funny how one thing, you know, like I'm doing this, and unknowingly this was going to help me get even better when it comes to acting. So it's weird how those things can end up relating.
I'm Shanna Sheehy.
Give a young person you know a boost by recognizing the good things they're doing. Nominate at spiritofyouth.org.
Provided by the Alaska State Division of Behavioral Health.
So, in the background, I think you may have heard the tailing off of Ken Fix, who was telling me briefly what he's going to talk about to us in a couple of minutes here. Ken is here from the Planetarium, and they're doing a show tonight. I kind of stumbled around at the start, but we finally settled that it's going to be tonight. And this one has a lot of interest because it begins with a discussion of Aries, who is the other side of the Mars from whom the planet is named or for whom the planet is named. And, of course, he's going to also have information on the multiplicity of vehicles that are floating or driving around on Mars and the other ones that have sort of landed there and you said maybe being assembled into a giant robot to be sent back
to
us.
I think the Martians are kind of putting that together and saying, well, we're going to make a giant robot out of this and we're going to send it back to you. It's kind of like where the Transformers came from.
So, Ken, give us some of that background you were telling me earlier about Ares.
Okay, Ares was the Greek god of chaotic conflict and battle lust. You know, basically you consider him the god of testosterone.
Mm-hmm.
He was Ares was Zeus and Hera's son, but they sort of disowned him after a while. I mean, he was just too out of control. He and Aphrodite had a famous affair among gods and goddesses. And Aphrodite's husband, Hephaestus, who was the god of the forge, was always trying to catch them in the act. And at one point, he enlisted Helios, the sun god, to try and catch the lovers at their deed and expose them to the other gods and goddesses. And Ares had enlisted a young boy named Electrion to keep watch and let them know if they spotted Helios, the sun god, you know, arising and starting his day, so that he would, you know, be able to observe them. Electrion fell asleep at his post, and Ares got very mad at him after the exposure of their affair became public, and he turned Electrion into a rooster. And that's why the rooster crows every morning, is to announce the arrival of the sun, you know, because... You know, he failed when he was a human, so now all roosters announce the arrival of the sun and the start of the day.
Ken, I had worried and wondered about that for probably half of my life, and you've cleared it up.
That's why roosters crow in the morning. There
well,
you go.
I am grateful. I am grateful for knowing this. So, Mars and Aries are like two, you know, they're both the same person.
Correct. It's the same god. The Romans changed it a little bit when they adopted the Greek pantheon of gods. They called him Mars. He became more of a father of the city, so the Romans actually worshipped him as, you know, like the paternal father, because Romulus and Remus were characters that founded Rome, and they were supposed to be Ares, Mars's sons. So the Romans felt a real, you know, attachment to the god Mars, and of course there were temples erected to him in Rome where there was hardly any worship of Ares as a god in the ancient Greek society. But as far as the Romans go, you know, any time that they were going into battle, the leader, whoever was taking their forces into battle, would shake his spear at the front end of their battle lines and say, "Mars awaken, Mars awaken," because they wanted Mars's help in any of the battles that were to come. So that's kind of a little bit of difference between the Romans and the Greeks there. Now, as far as the planet goes, Mars is not our closest planetary neighbor. That honor goes to Venus. But Venus is very inhospitable and not anywhere near likely to have a colony on it or any human visitors anytime, probably in the foreseeable eons. Mars is a little bit more like our planet because it has a similar axial tilt. Its day is 24 hours and 37 minutes long, so it's, you know, almost the same as what we've got. Only it's a little less than half the size of the Earth, and like a person on Earth, if you weigh 100 pounds on the Earth, you'd weigh 38 pounds on Mars. So the gravity's lighter, also has a very thin carbon dioxide atmosphere, no really good magnetic field to keep the sun's radiation away from it, so radiation is also a hazard on the surface, and that's another thing that the rovers are trying to detect is exactly how much radiation any potential human visitors would be exposed to.
So the Earth has the magnetosphere surrounding it, which absorbs incoming high-energy particles.
Correct, plus our atmosphere, too.
Right, and those two elements are not present to that degree on Mars. So.
No, Mars has several magnetic fields. It may have had an active molten iron core at one time, just like the Earth has now, but that has since either frozen solid or is in the process of doing so, and that's why we have several magnetic fields that are present on Mars. It's not like one big one like we have on the Earth where you got a north and a south pole, and, you know, of course, a magnetosphere that helps protect us against solar winds and radiation.
Ken, early astronomers thought that there were canals on Mars. Where did that idea come from?
Very interesting story behind that one. Schiaparelli was the first one to observe Mars, but Percival Lowell did this extensive study, and he came up with these canals that he spotted on Mars. And, of course, they thought, oh, well, these had to be probably dug by intelligent beings or something like that, since he laid them out all nice and neatly. And of course, H.G. Wells picked up on that at the time and wrote the famous War of the Worlds book. You know, it's kind of goes back to my summer movie schedule where we fitted that one in. But the canals on Mars are very interesting because we have a Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter that's been around Mars for about, about 7 years now since it's been launched. But it's observed a phenomenon where a massive amount of dust devils have shown up, and they've actually scoured the Martian surface and removed the top layer of reddish soil and exposed a darker soil underneath. And I'll show pictures of this tonight, but it's like if you look through a telescope and saw that, you might think that that was canals or something else, too. And then, of course, additional winds probably blew more dirt and topsoil in and covered those darker areas back up. But you can think that, you know, gee, if I was Percival Lowell and I looked through a telescope and saw that, that might actually look like canals or channels that was on there. But, you know, I mean, our Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter has actually taken pictures of this. So it's pretty fascinating because I'll show a picture tonight that's really, you know, hammers that point home.
Now, we currently have, I think, three vehicles running around on the surface of Mars?
Well, there are actually four, and two of them are immobile right now.
Okay.
But two of them are identical in size and structure. That would be Spirit and Opportunity. Those two arrived in 2004 to do 90-day missions of planetary science, and lo and behold, they both went way past their warranties. Spirit eventually got stuck in a sand trap and went immobile and just became a stationary platform for a while.
I know some golfers who've had that same problem.
Okay. But, yeah. And they it actually wound up stationary, still transmitted data, but as of the fall of 2010, it wasn't transmitting anymore. From where it was sitting and the tilt, its solar panels weren't getting enough energy, and it locked itself down into safe mode and is no longer communicating, even though we'd sent replies back and, you know, back and forth to try and get it to wake up. So it's pretty much dead. Opportunity, on the other hand, is still out there roving around. I mean, this thing's been out there for over 3,100 days doing work, and its original planned mission was 90 days. So we're sure getting our money out of that as a taxpayer. I mean, that thing's just going like crazy, Energizer Bunny loose on Mars. Right now it's at Endeavour Crater, and it's still doing planetary science work. So definitely a big plus for us because it's lasted a lot longer than we thought it was. Go backwards, 1996, we landed a mission called Pathfinder. And the little rover that was on that was called Sojourner, and it is I mean, it's probably a box, you know, it's like one of those boxes that you ship large flat rate stuff through United, you know, Post Office. It's about that big. It wasn't really that large.
Couple feet cube.
Yeah, and it only went for, you know, a few days. It wasn't designed to do very much. And, of course, very quickly wound up outside of its lifespan and was not heard from again. Now, the one that we've just landed on August 6th is Curiosity. It's also called the Mars Science Laboratory, but everybody's going to know it by Curiosity. This used a very unique system to get it onto the surface of Mars, where they actually lowered it on a series of wires. It's called the Sky Crane. And once it touched down, then the Sky Crane sort of took off and crashed a few hundred yards away. But it was trying to give the rover a very smooth touchdown and give it a pristine landing spot to begin its work. Now, we landed in an area called Gale Crater. Gale Crater is right on the edge of where the lowlands, which go into the north half of Mars, are separated from the highlands, which is much higher terrain on the southern half of Mars. So it's right on the edge of there, and we believe that liquid water was there at one time. In fact, we've proven that there's ice there already. The Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter verified that there is liquid water ice on Mars. So we believe that there was a big, huge ocean at one time, and it's right on the edge of that is where Gale Crater is, and we're trying to analyze a series of layers that are in that crater that are put down by sedimentary rock. So it's as the waters dried up, it left this sediment, and it's by going through those layers that we hope to find evidence of microbial life and also more clues as to what the atmosphere was like when Mars was loaded with water, which was probably 3.5 billion years ago.
Ken, this is a fascinating program. What time are you starting tonight?
It's 6:30 at the Marie Drake Planetarium, and it should run until about 7:30 or so.
Okay. Mars, Aries, the landers, all wrapped up into one fabulous presentation.
Oh, yeah, I'll be covering as much as I can. I'm leaving the Russian missions out, but most of those were failures. I think they only got two probes out of a dozen that actually landed safely on Mars. The rest of them either failed trying to get into the low Earth orbit, or they crashed into Mars, or something happened that they weren't heard from again. But, yeah, just the United States rovers and our missions, from Mariners up through the Viking missions and to the ones that we've got right now, and plus current photos from Curiosity on Mars.
For someone who has never been to the planetarium before, tell us how to get there.
Okay, we're on Glacier Highway. If you're coming from the valley, you make the left turn onto Highland Drive, and the very first right will be Glacier. You'll go past where all the soccer fields are, and as soon as they end where the fence ends, there's a sidewalk that goes to the right. The Marie Drake building will have a very distinctive round structure on the top. That's actually the dome of the planetarium. And if you went all the way to where the Blockbuster is, you went too far.
Outstanding. Ken Fix, thank you so much.
Thanks again.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 25th of September, 2012. It's the birthday of the man who said, "Most men are a little better than their circumstances give them a chance to be." The novelist William Faulkner, born New Albany, Mississippi, 1897. Like to get up early in the morning, eat eggs and broiled steak for breakfast, get a pot of coffee, take his tobacco and pipe, and go up to his study, where he went inside and took off the doorknob and carried it inside with him, where he wrote his novels by hand on large sheets of paper and then typed them out with two fingers on an old Underwood portable. In a 4-year span, he published some of his best works: Sartorus, The Sound and the Fury, As I Lay Dying, Sanctuary, and Light in August, all between 1929 and 1932. It was on this day, 1957, 9 African-American students were successfully registered at Little Rock Central High School, which had been segregated. They'd been chosen by the NAACP based on their good grades and their good behavior. Just weeks before, Governor Faubus of Arkansas had mobilized the National Guard to keep them from entering the school. The NAACP took the case to court, and President Eisenhower federalized the National Guard and sent federal troops to Little Rock to opened the blockade. There was an angry mob that showed up. They heckled the students. They spat at them as members of the 101st Airborne escorted the kids through the front doors of the school. The nine students were taunted and abused, humiliated for the rest of the school year, and it would be 15 years after that before all of Arkansas's schools would finally be integrated. In 1999, the original nine students went to Washington and received the Congressional Gold Medal for their service. It's the birthday of the poet and cartoonist Shel Silverstein, born in Chicago, 1930. He said as a kid he wanted to be popular with girls, but he couldn't play ball and he couldn't dance, so he started to draw and write. He was drafted into the Army, wrote cartoons for Stars and Stripes. After the war, went to work for Playboy magazine, contributed there for 20 years. It was an editor in New York who suggested that he try to write for children, and he went on to write some of the best-known children's books of our time, Lafcadio, The Lion Who Shot Back, and The Giving Tree, and his book of children's poems, Where the Sidewalk Ends, one of the best-selling volumes of poetry of all time. And it was on this day, 1981, Sandra Day O'Connor was sworn in as a justice in the Supreme Court, first woman to hold that office. She graduated from Stanford Law School, 1952, top of her class, couldn't find a law firm that would give her a job because she was a woman. So she moved to Arizona, opened up her own law practice, became active in the Republican Party, became majority leader of the Arizona State Senate, then was appointed to the Court of Appeals, and 2 years later, President Reagan appointed her to the Supreme Court. Here's a poem for today by Shel Silverstein, No Difference. Small as a peanut, big as a giant, we're all the same size when we turn off the light. Rich as a sultan, poor as a mite, we're all worth the same when we turn off the light. Red, black, or orange, yellow, or white, we all look the same when we turn off the light. So maybe the way to make everything right is for God to just reach out and turn off the light. No Difference by Shel Silverstein from his collection A Light in the Attic, published by HarperCollins and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Reputation.com, a service for managing businesses' online image by working to improve how they look in search engines and review sites, Reputation.com. Written by Joy Biles, produced by Nick Vetter. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
You're in tune with KTOO. Kari Groven is here to fill us in on a program that's coming up that trains teachers to teach in the classroom. Hi, Kari.
Hi.
So tell us.
Yes, it's to train artists to teach in the classroom.
Yes.
And, we're taking registrations right now. And this program is for artists who are interested in teaching in the schools, doing residencies in the schools, but would like to get some more tools for how to do that. Or also artists who have already been teaching in the schools for a short while or a long while, but kind of want to get on the same wavelength that as everybody else. So we will start the residency on a Saturday, October 27th, with an intensive session at the Glacier Valley School. And then we will continue with 4 Monday sessions from 5 to 7 o'clock, covering various subjects. And then we'll, in between there, there will be, in the beginning of the program, the artists will get a chance to observe a class. And then they are expected to write a lesson plan, mm-hmm. and they will get the tools on how to do that as a part of the academy. And then towards the end of the period, they get to teach their lesson. So that it's kind of 1 hour of the first and 1 hour of the second when they're teaching their lesson.
So, Kari, for this to happen, though, you have to have a minimum enrollment of 10. Is that right?
That is correct. Minimum of 10, maximum of 15.
Okay.
So if anyone is interested, they should call me at the Juno Arts and Humanities Council office. We're based at the Juno Arts and Culture Center. And the phone number there is 586-2787.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, and they can also email me at kari@jahc.org. And I want to say that the teachers that we have for this academy they're just phenomenal. We're really lucky to have those teachers there. One of them is Lynn Williams. She will, among other things, she will talk about classroom management, which is kind of a biggie for a lot of people. She got the Presidential Award for Excellence in Teaching Mathematics and Science, and she's a Grinder State Associate for Nonverbal Classroom Management. We have Lori Hege, which is a Glacier Valley music teacher and librarian. She was the Alaska State Teacher of the Year in 2011. We have Annie Calkins, who is the Alaska State Council on the Arts Special Projects Coordinator for Arts Education, and then we have two phenomenal teaching artists. We're also teaching this. Ryan Conroe, who's also an actor and a director, and the same with Roblin Davis. He will probably be teaching. So, yeah.
So people need to register by what date?
By October 19th. It's $70 for the series. If there's enough demand, we'll set up a UAS credit course as well for an additional $90.
Okay, but you have to have 10 people in order to register, so we need people to make a commitment to this thing as soon as possible so we know it's going to go.
Yes.
Okay, good. So one more time, your contact information?
My contact information is kari@jahc.org or call 586-2787 or 586-ARTS, A-R-T-S.
Outstanding. Thank you, Kari.
Thank you.
Support for programming on this station is provided by Lauren Jones, candidate for the City and Borough Assembly. Paid for by Jones for Assembly, Box 240703, Douglas.
Throughout the month of September, we've been doing a special on every Tuesday that involves an issue about sustainability. And we went to MRV Architects here in Juneau and talked to Paul Volkers. And Paul won an award for designing his building in a sustainable fashion. Here's that interview. We're sitting in the conference room of the MRV Architects headquarters, and I'm talking with Paul about the firm. When you constructed this building, you actually fairly early on in the process decided to go after a national award called the LEED Award. What does that mean? What is the award?
Well, it's more of, I think the term is certification, but LEED, L-E-E-D, stands for Leadership in Environmental and Energy Design, and that's become a bit of a nationally branded name, like Kleenex or something, and it's become the best system for sustainable or green design buildings. And so this whole movement or I think key shift toward better buildings, more sustainable buildings really got going in earnest about 2000 or so. And so MRV joined that United States Green Building Council in 2002 and immediately started involvement with a few other commercial projects that we work on that were starting to try to get certified under this relatively exciting new program in the early 2000s. So when we started working on this building in 2006, 2007, we already had two or three under our belt, and that became an obvious goal then to try to set for ourselves to say, okay, if it works with, you know, museums and libraries around the state, maybe we can do this as our own private sector building and see if it can work at a, you know, kind of a hard nuts and bolts economic sense for us as well. And we ended up getting a what's called a silver level of certification. And when we finished that in, I think, 2009, when we finally got all the paperwork back, we were the first in the state of Alaska. And we may still be the only private project in the state of Alaska, which surprises me a little bit.
What is it that makes this building green or sustainable? I know that's a broad question, but I'm wondering if you can kind of summarize it.
Sure. And maybe I'll use that as a preamble to a broader question. One of the things that we've found, especially in Alaska, is you want to be careful in terms of labeling that sometimes carries negative baggage. And for much of the country, the term green is great. I find some parts of Alaska, if you're not careful, that term itself can be a little misleading, or at least get people kind of get their antenna up or quivering about what does this mean exactly. So the way I tend to couch it is that these LEED or green buildings are basically smart buildings or high-performance buildings, and I think once you break it down into those kind of terms, it becomes a very easy sell, actually, for many Alaskan clients to understand that. And so who doesn't want a building that costs less to operate or costs less to maintain in the future or has happier occupants, you know, with higher, you know, efficiencies and productivity? So that's what I think this program really comes to represent, is that whole buzzword for green building or sustainable building, really, when you get behind that term, means simply buildings that work better.
So you've opened another dimension here, because we tend to think of green in terms of energy efficiency, but you talked about worker efficiency or human efficiency. Could you expand on that a little?
Sure. And I think actually that's one of the strengths of this whole LEED program, is it's holistic and doesn't look at just one aspect of building design. And I would argue that maybe of these various holistic areas that the LEED design looks at, energy efficiency may be one of the biggest pieces of that. But again, you look at the whole piece, and there are they're very interesting and I'd say almost amazing statistics on the productivity increases that you see in buildings that are silver or LEED certified, and what that means then in terms of how happy the occupants are and the corresponding increase then in productivity. And that comes from subtle things like absence for illnesses and various things, because they simply end up being happier, healthier buildings in general due to access to daylight, better ventilation requirements, that sort of thing.
So when you began working on the building, how did you design those factors into the building? Can you give us some examples of what you did to make the environment happier and healthier?
Sure. So what happens with this LEED program, and maybe I can give a little background there first, and it helps answer that question, is there's at least five different broad categories of emphasis that this program has you look at for each building project. And it starts very general with things like site and location, energy is a category, water efficiency is a category, healthy materials, and then things like access to daylight. Those are all different categories within that. So when you're sitting down in the early design parts of a project, the early design stages, it's important then to sit down and speculate about how your new building is going to best achieve those different areas. So in our case, and some of these things that are associated then with a healthy, productive building are things that I think in Alaska are no-brainer, like good access to daylight. So as we walk around the building, you'll see that we have lots of windows, and the majority of those windows are operable windows. That's a fairly simple thing, but a key determinant, frankly, in how happy people are in their environment, because they can directly control it. So again, that seems like a no-brainer, but if you contrast that against a big, you know, sort of classic Dilbert-type office cubicle environment, those are what make people very unhappy, because they have no direct control over their environment, and frequently you're cut off from daylight and you're subject to the whims of a mechanical system. And so we've tried to break that down a little bit, again with windows, individual control of environment, and just trying to keep the workspaces sort of smaller and more humane.
And then Are there things that you do with, like, color or the placement of objects and that sort of thing? Is that a component of this?
I'm not sure that's a specific component of this, but it's part of a good holistic approach to design, of course. And so I think that whole issue of a focus, for instance, on sometimes some how do I phrase this? Things like lots of windows and daylight access actually runs a little bit contrary to absolute energy efficiency. So there's a little bit of a dynamic tension in how you reconcile that in a good building. And so you have to be mindful of the type of interior spaces you're creating at the same time that you're looking at these overall goals of energy efficiency and things.
Well, shall we take a walk around?
Sure.
So this is the main entry with a desk for the receptionist and a huge wall of windows that goes on two walls here with the doorway.
So this building, we purchased this as a shuttered doctor's office. For those of you that remember Dr. Akiyama, we bought his property and did a conversion that tried to use as much of that old building as we could. So again, that's sort of a common sense thing about minimizing new materials that are required and maximizing reuse of existing things. There's a lot of emphasis in this LEED program for trying to work within existing city infrastructure, which again I think makes perfect sense, because then you're suddenly tied to bus lines, you're pedestrian friendly, and you can ride a bike to work, all those sort of things, and you're not creating or requiring the city to extend sewer lines or water lines or whatever to build on new property. So we took Akiyama's old clinic, and actually we've got a bit of a sort of a playful reversion here, where this is the area of the building that used to have rock walls, and those rock walls had some rot and various things, and so we decided just to open that up and make it a glass welcoming entry system. And then the rest of the framing, as you look around, it used to be a series of small individual exam rooms, and we've added, as a first step in the renovation, these exposed beams running the length of the building that allowed us to take out those small partitions and essentially open up the interior of the space. And so as we walk around, you'll note that there's a series then of roughly 9 by 9 individual workstations, each with windows and lights and things that are individually controlled. So we get a combination of individual space as well as a bit of, you know, shared work environment that works fairly well, at least in our business, where that some degree of collegiality is important. So shared library areas. We've included a...
We're walking down a hallway here that has bookshelves on both sides of the hallway, and a strip of fluorescent lights that at the moment is turned off because no one's using the space, but easily lit up and like that. And then there's a break room in front of us here.
And the break room actually includes a bathroom with a shower. So one of the other things that LEED tries to do is make sure that when you are doing a new building, you build in sometimes relatively simple steps that allow you to have better practices in the future. So a prerequisite, or I guess it isn't a prerequisite, but a strongly recommended credit includes the provision of a bike rack and a shower, so that people then are encouraged, you know, to go ahead and either walk or bike to work and be able to take advantage of that amenity.
Does your staff walk or bike to work?
A fair bit do, yeah.
Okay.
When you get to that October time of year, there's maybe a little less of that happening. So same thing on this side. You'll see it's just a friendly, where we've opened up and removed the various partitions. But notice the scale of the windows at each station and the fact that these are operable, and everybody has pretty good ability to control their space. One of the other areas that you haven't asked yet on LEED that you see built in here is a lot of concern for healthy materials. And when the LEED program first started in earnest, say 10 years ago, it was relatively difficult to specify chemically inert products. There was a lot of research where we knew that formaldehyde was bad, and a lot of the volatile organic solvents that come out of paints and varnishes and things were very unhealthy for folks, and that was really why a new building has a certain smell. Well, LEED promulgated a whole set of practices that got rid of those toxic chemicals coming out of materials. And what we've seen in the last 4 or 5 years is a vast change in the types of products that are available. So simple things like carpet and a carpet pad, adhesives that are used in the ceiling tile, the paint itself, all of these are very healthy. They didn't degas at all. So that's one of the subtle things that leads to things like the productivity gains, and you don't have people complaining of raspy throats or whatever because the building is simply easier in terms of the interior environment.
How do the costs compare when you buy that kind of material as opposed to the types of material that are not LEED certified kind of things?
Yeah, that's a fair question. And again, as a consequence of this program and others like it pushing the manufacturing industry, those sort of cost premiums that you might have had 10 years ago have reduced a lot, and I might even say have essentially vanished at this point, because if you use paint, for instance, as an example, they have, you know, their EcoSpec line or whatever, where it's become essentially the default product, and simply the chemistry has changed a little bit. And so that now doesn't have a big penalty associated with it. There are some additional costs required to do a LEED program. Part of it is because there will be an emphasis on greater energy efficiency, and there's a greater emphasis on proving out that you do what you say you're going to do in a building called commissioning. And those steps do take additional outlay of money, but the bit of research that's been done on that has proven that generally, you see a very rapid payback, something like 5 to 7 years, to recoup those first costs, because the building obviously performs better if you've made those, energy upgrades and made sure that the systems are running as intended.
MRV is an architect firm. Have your clients responded to your LEED certification and to this building as a way to lead to bring them to the same kind of construction?
That's a little hard to prove for sure, but I think the answer is yes. And we have a very clever website manager, and he's actually able to give us some statistics back on what people find interesting on our website. And our LEED, green design, is sort of a subset of our projects that we profile on the webpage, and that, I think, gets the most hits. So of the various things we're doing, that is one of the more important. And we have that's a part of our resume that we really are pretty, careful to cultivate, too, with a number of local projects, for instance, like the Sobolov Center that's going to be built here in Juneau starting this next year. From the outset, that client group was interested that the project be LEED Gold, unquestionable. They said that's so tied in so well to, say, native long-term values that they just wanted the building to embody those best sustainable practices. And so they knew that MRV had a bit of a reputation in that field anyway, so there is kind of a nice mutual synergy there.
Wonderful. Thank you, Paul, for this conversation about the LEED Award for MRV Architects and about the ongoing LEED construction in Juneau.
My pleasure. I think it's a very important topic and pleased to talk about it.
We recorded Paul Volkers at MRV Architects as he took us on a little tour of the building, and we'll be back with another sustainability segment next Tuesday. Through the month of October, we're going to look at issues of how to reduce the waste stream in Juneau.
Award-winning children's musician Jim Cosgrove is coming to Juneau this September 30th. The show kicks off at 2 p.m. at the Juneau Douglas High School. Cosgrove is one of the country's leading kid rockers and family entertainers. Get tickets online at jahc.org and junomontessori.org, or in person at the school, the Jacks, Hearthside Books, Rainy Retreat, and The Door. This concert is a fundraiser for the Juneau Montessori School. That's kid rocker Jim Cosgrove performing September 30th at 2 p.m. at the Juneau Douglas High School.
It's just about 9 and a half minutes before 4 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News. My next guest involves me getting called to the principal's office, which is always an exciting thing. It happened to me not infrequently during my school career. My guest is the principal of Floyd Dryden Middle School, Tom Milliron. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, hi, Pat. How are you?
Good enough. So
good.
Tell us what's going on that's exciting this semester at Floyd Dryden.
Well, we've got 5 weeks under our belt so far, but as far as new and exciting is concerned, we have a couple initiatives that we started, and perhaps the most high-profile one that is that of a blended education mastery-based pilot for a team of our sixth-grade students. And by blended education, I'm referring to a combination of both computer-based instruction and teacher-facilitated instruction. The idea is to, do two things. First of all, meet students where they're at academically, and then to allow them to grow from where they are at their pace. Bottom line is that eliminates seat time to some extent. By default, some students may be able to get through a sixth grade math class curriculum in less than the usual assigned seat time, that of a school year. So maybe they take 4 months instead of 9 months, or 8 months instead of 9 months, and they can continue on into the next level, that of a seventh grade math class. Conversely, we have students who require a little bit more time. Maybe they're starting not quite at sixth grade level yet, or maybe it just takes them a little bit longer to process and master the concepts. So instead of, at the end of 9 months, you better be done with this program or we're going to label you a failure. Instead, they get the additional time they need to continue on and master the concepts associated with sixth grade math, whether that takes 10 months or 11 months. So that's an exciting program that we have in place. It's one team of sixth grade students that amounts to about 60 students.
And these 60 students are they in a single class or are they spread out across the school?
They're on one sixth grade team. We have a team teaching structure in place at Floyd Dryden. So at sixth and seventh grade, usually two teachers, one who has a math science background and another teacher with a language arts social studies background, share a team of about 60 students. And the idea is to create a smaller learning community within a school of 570 students, so the students feel attached to a core group of kids and two teachers. But at the same time, during their exploratory, or what I used to know as elective classes, the kids get all mixed up. So even though we have three sixth-grade teams, and those kids stay with their team for their four core classes, math, science, language arts, and social studies, those three teams of sixth graders then get all mixed up for their four elective classes, so they all get to know each other.
I'll date myself here, but when I was going through high school, I can remember that we had honors classes, and those were for students that tested high on some placement tests and like that, and then some of us were in classes that were honors English or honors math. Is this similar to that?
Well, each team, by this, are you referring, Pat, to the blended education?
To the blended mastery? Education. I know you basically can speed up or slow down the presentation as it kind of matches to the student's ability to absorb the material.
Right. The 60 students are demographically representative of our Floyd Dryden population as a whole. So we have the whole spectrum of ability levels and also the demographics as far as ethnicity, gender, et cetera. The idea is at the end of the school year, we're going to look at several data sources to determine the success or effectiveness of this pilot. And in order to have it be able to transfer to other groups or other classes as far as having data that's representative of what can be replicated, we need a demographically representative group of kids in the pilot this year. So a long answer to your short question is that, no, it's not an advanced placement. However, of course, we do have students working at the advanced level, as one would expect if you have a group of 60 kids that represent the population as a whole.
Are the students that are on this 60-person team, are they more or less fixed in that team for the course of the year? Do they have any options to, like, join or not join or drop out?
Well, and that's a great question. In other words, how did we put those 60 kids together in a way that does represent our school as a whole? In May, we made up our three sixth grade teams of about 60 kids each, as we normally would. Then randomly pulled one of the team's names out of a hat, literally, and said, okay, this is going to be our targeted group for our blended education pilot. Made parent contact before school started, had a parent evening where both teachers who had volunteered and been trained on how to do the program, myself, our Superintendent Gilbreth, and a couple other district employees were there and shared the whole idea behind the program. And then parents made their decision as to whether they wanted their son or daughter in the program. So completely voluntary on the part of the parents and the students to participate. And out of our 60 students, we only had one opt out. So we're just very pleased with how well the program was received. And 5 weeks into the school year, very pleased at the progress we're making. A lot of learning taking place at both the teacher principal level as well as the student level on how to make this program work.
It's wonderful when the program can teach the principal and the teachers as well as teach the students in the class.
A lot of learning taking place on at all aspects of the program. We had a trainer come up to train us how to use the curriculum, and also had some other administrators and teachers participate throughout the district in the training. So there's potential should the data support and the parents-student qualitative feedback support it. There's potential for expanding the program.
Tom Milliron, principal at Floyd Dryden, thank you for bringing us up to date on a new and exciting program that's going on at your school.
Hey, my pleasure, Pat. Thank you for the time.
You bet.
The thunder and the lightning make me cry, but I have faith in the morning light, so there's no more crying tonight. Every little thing gonna be.
We go out with a little bit of music from Cosgrove coming up Sunday afternoon, 4 o'clock, Jim Cosgrove's concert at the JDHS Auditorium to benefit the Montessori schools. Today we heard about Ken Fix doing a special talk on Mars at 6:30 tonight at the Planetarium. Don't forget the Great Pumpkin Festival coming up Thursday through Sunday at the Jack and out at Sandy Beach. And be sure you call Kari Groven if you're an artist and you're interested in signing up for the Artist Teaching Academy. Andy Klein will be coming in tomorrow. His ghost guests include folks from Perseverance's Theaters of Mice and Men production, some folks to talk about hospice volunteer training opportunities. Jim Cosgrove himself will be on the show tomorrow with Andy, and they'll talk about the concert coming up Sunday. And Melissa Kukish and Nicole Hollingstad will be here to talk about the Sea Alaska and Central Counselors voter registration event this weekend. You're in tune with KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM. In downtown Juneau and Douglas. We're also on a set of translators throughout the area. In the Valley and Auk Bay, you can hear us on 103.1 K276 AF. In Lemon and Spicer Creek, we're on K269 AO at 101.7. K201 AM serves Gustavus at 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, we're on K210 AS at 89.9.
I'll wipe your tears because there's no more crying tonight. Every little thing gonna be alright. Every little thing gonna be alright. Every little thing gonna be alright. And there's no more crying tonight. I said every little thing gonna be alright.